Our first case is Briscoe Bay versus Land Act. Simon Schuster, Penguin Group, both parties ready?
Yeah,
Thanks. A couple of housekeeping matters. Justice Coates had a minor emergency, personal emergency, and won't be here today. But he'll participate. Second, argument set for an hour, half an hour aside, and the petitioner will have to keep track of your time. When you stand up and start your argument, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And for those of you here, I want to let you know that most of us use iPads, and we have all our briefs and notes and links to Westlaw, so we're not surfing and sending out emails while you're arguing. With that, let's start.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Fred Bauman, and along with my partner, Jesus Vasquez, we represent Briscoe Bay Productions in this case. The courts below made two errors, one substantive, one procedural. First, the courts expanded the doctrine of issue preclusion, otherwise known as collateral estoppel, far beyond the scope previously authorized by this court. They ruled that where two parties are accused of similar acts of fraud, a finding that one party's fraud did not proximately cause harm to the plaintiff precludes and bars a jury from even considering whether the other party's fraud did cause harm. Those holdings, apart from well-established cases in this court, exemplified by the Krulik case, that proximate cause is always an individualized determination and must be made on a defendant-by-defendant basis. The application of issue preclusion to the facts of this case is also inconsistent with this court's most recent decision on the subject in Reynolds last year. Reynolds held that a subsequent suit cannot be barred unless the prior judgment actually and necessarily determined the identical issue as that sought to be litigated in the later case. The second error is the procedural error. The courts below dismissed Briscoe Bay's claims based on the affirmative defense of issue preclusion under Rule 12b-5 without converting to summary judgment. In doing so, they ignored not only the plain language of the rule, but also this court's decision in Root in favor of what the appellees characterize as a modern trend in federal cases. The failure to convert to honor this court's rules and law harmed Briscoe Bay because, of course, under Colorado's unique fee-shifting statute, 1317-201, the dismissal under Rule 12b subjects Briscoe Bay to an award of attorney's fees, whereas a dismissal on summary judgment would not. This court should reverse on both the substantive and the procedural issue and remand this matter for trial on Briscoe's claims against the publisher. The dispute before this court has a long and tortured history and will not repeat it here as set forth in our briefs.
Well, given all that, Mr. Bauman, it looks as if our trial court did look at the substance of what the California jury decided based on, and a pretty good inquiry, it seems, based on whether the issue you had a full and fair opportunity to litigate, and in view of the special interrogatory answers the California jury rendered, basically, isn't the claim identical in the same suits that this alleged misrepresentation of the number of books that Clyde Cussler had sold, quote, end quote, produced Briscoe Bay's damages, and that California jury found that it did not. So aren't you just kind of relying on technicalities rather than the actual substance of whether the issue was fairly litigated and determined?
I don't think so, Justice Hobbs, for the following reasons. One, there is no question that only Mr. Cussler's statements were before the court in California. The only claims in that case involved Mr. Cussler, who was the plaintiff in that case and was a counterclaim, or in California, a cross-claim defendant on Bristol Bay's fraud claim. Second, and more importantly, the jury's proximate cause determination from the jury verdict form is phrased solely in terms of Cussler's representations and whether they proximately caused any harm.
But didn't the publishers just take those representations and put them on the covers of the books?
Well, actually, Your Honor, the record would suggest it's the other way around. The publishers are the ones who know how many books they have printed, or should know how many books they have printed and sold. And it was Mr. Cussler's testimony that he didn't even really know. He just relied upon what the publishers told him and his agent, and he may or may not have used sold or printed. There was a big dispute about that in California, but what wasn't at issue in California was whether the jury had in front of it only whether Mr. Cussler's single misrepresentation about books sold caused any harm.
Why didn't you join the publishers in the California suit?
You need to go back a little bit in history to explain that. The case in California was filed in 2004. During the course of discovery in that case, in the summer of 2006, Bristol Bay, or its predecessor, then received for the first time information that would suggest that the statements that had been made to it about the number of books sold or in print were false. We moved in California to amend our cross-claim, claim against Cussler, because that's a compulsory claim, Mr. Cussler being a party. We did not seek to add any new parties to the California action because that would inevitably have delayed that action, which is already 2 years old, substantially further. Instead, what we did is we filed the suits here. We filed here before the jury verdict in California against the Lamp Act defendants, and then we subsequently amended that suit. We did not learn of the fraud, in other words, until the summer of 2006. Statutes of limitation, both here and in California, give us several years within which to file that claim, and we did in a timely fashion here.
Mr. Baum, could you just respond to the trial court's finding or conclusion that the alleged misrepresentations concerning sales or printings of Cussler's novels actually undergird all the claims in this case, whether asserted against Cussler's agents or his publishers? What's wrong with that from your point of view?
There's nothing wrong with that as a general statement. It is true that the claims in our case, both cases, are based upon the misrepresentations that were made to Bristol Bay that induced it to enter into the contract and to spend over $100 million producing a movie that didn't make anywhere near that kind of money. The problem is that's an oversimplification of the law of proximate cause. It has always been true that proximate cause can be determined and must be determined on an individual by individual basis. Who commits the fraud is as important as what the fraud was. In H&H, for example, cited it repeatedly in our brief, and the Court of Appeals in that case upheld a jury determination where there were two defendants. The fraud claim was entered against both of them, but damages were awarded only against one of the defendants. The claim was made that that was inconsistent, that how could you have fraud but no damages against one, and fraud and $1.3 million in damages against the other party. Court of Appeals said that's not inconsistent because the jury was entitled to determine that the fraud by one of the parties caused the harm, even if the fraud didn't cause harm by the other party. The fraud there was substantially the same. It was misrepresentations about a marketing program. And that is very analogous to the situation we have here. The allegations against Cussler in California and the allegations against the publishers here are similar in that they relate to the number of books, the size of the potential audience. But the fact is, it is a jury determination, not a judicial determination as a matter of law, that each of those misrepresenters should be assessed individually. That's all we're asking for. We're asking for the right to present to a jury the claim that a misrepresentation about the number of books that Mr. Cusser is responsible for, made by the people who published those books for decades, could have been the cause of harm to Bristol Bay, even if a misrepresentation by a single author in the context of negotiations on a book deal, book movie deal, wasn't the cause. The one does not preclude the other. And yet, the courts below made that decision as a matter of law. All we want is our day in court on the claims against the publishers.
Counsel, your opposing counsel suggests that really what the California jury found was that Bristol Bay wasn't harmed by its reliance on these misrepresentations. And because it wasn't harmed, it really doesn't matter who gave these misrepresentations. And so the proximate cause isn't really the issue. If the jury made a finding that essentially said, there's no injury here, you're therefore barred. Why is that wrong? How do you read the jury verdict not to encompass that?
Your Honor, the jury verdict doesn't say, was Bristol Bay harmed? The jury verdict says, was Bristol's reliance on Cusser's representation a substantial factor in causing harm to Bristol Bay? And the jury said, no. We don't know. Simple answer to your question is we don't know because the jury didn't tell us. There are two, at least two, equally viable hypotheses as to what the California jury intended by its proximate cause verdict. One, it could have concluded that Bristol Bay wasn't harmed by anybody's misrepresentation. That's the position that my worthy opponents take. But it is equally as possible that the jury could conclude that Cusler's misrepresentation didn't harm Bristol Bay because Bristol Bay was already harmed by the publisher's misrepresentation. It is that uncertainty.
And that's your comparison to the H&H case.
Exactly. Okay. This court said last term in Reynolds, in order to preclude a subsequent case, you must have the identical issue and it must be actually and necessarily decided. Well, here, how do we know what was actually and necessarily decided in California? I submit that while the court looked at thousands of pages of documents, it is the jury instructions that were given to the jury, and it is the verdict form.
And well, the jury apparently felt that it was the movie itself that was the problem for the failure to make money.
Well, I don't know that I can agree with that. I've seen the movie, and I could see where one could come to that conclusion. But there is nothing in the jury verdict, the actual words of this jury, that tell us.
It was an evidence, right? And they watched it. And the issue was whether there was any significant harm caused by whatever number of books was represented and sold, you know. The puffing that goes into the eagerness of making a contract and publishing books and selling books. Apparently, when the jury looked at the evidence, and aside from the answers to the individual questions and how they were framed, don't we have to give some nod to their ultimate decision that Bristol Bay is claiming damages for what amounts to failure to make money in a risky market, that is, having a successful movie?
That was one of the viable defenses submitted by Mr. Cusler in California. But again, we don't know. It is the uncertainty associated with the way the jury verdict is phrased that gives rise to the possibility that we have claims that have never been submitted to a jury. Claims we seek here to assert against the publishers. Those claims have never gone to a jury, and yet we're going to be barred from them based upon supposition as to what the jury in California might have concluded with respect to the cause of the harm. That's where we come back to proximate cause should be an individual defendant by defendant determination. And the Court of Appeals decision and the trial court's decision here stands that on its head because we're barred from making that determination. And unless we know for sure we cannot apply, I submit, the equitable doctrine of issue preclusion unless you're absolutely sure what was decided in the prior action and it's absolutely identical to what you seek to argue here. We are not aware of a single case that has barred issue preclusion, that has barred a subsequent case based on issue preclusion, where it's a different actor's conduct involved. We're not aware of it.
So there has to be perfect identity of the parties. That's your argument as a matter of law.
Not of parties, Your Honor. Of the issues.
Well, no, you're saying defendant. We get to go after a different defendant.
As long as the misrepresentation is an individualized misrepresentation of a different actor, here the publishers, it's a different claim. And a jury is entitled to assess that. No jury has ever assessed whether the publishers' fraudulent statements cause harm to Bristol Bay. That's all we're asking for.
Counsel, could I have you elaborate a little bit on the distinctions between Cussler's representations and representations made by the publisher? Are they materially different, and if so, how?
They're different. The question of whether they're materially different is with the publisher's statements are phrased by and large in terms of the books in print and in terms, in some cases, of readership. Mr. Cussler's representation at issue in California was phrased in terms of books sold. There was testimony in California, as I know the record reflects, that there's a distinction between books sold and books published. You print more books than are actually sold, and it's a sort of an accounting nightmare. For purposes of this argument, we concede that it is a similar claim that we're seeking to assert against the publishers as the misrepresentation claim against Clive Cussler, because it goes to the same issue, and that is the assessment by my client of the potential size of the market for any movies it would make from the Cussler franchise.
So the idea that it induced reliance by Bristol Bay to enter into the arrangement.
We would not have either entered into a contract that paid an unprecedented amount of money to Mr. Cussler or sunk $100 million into a movie if we knew at the time that the size of that audience was no more than 40 million.
Could, Mr. Bauman, I think that's, I'm sure that's absolutely accurate, but I didn't quite get the answer to Justice Marquez's question.
Are they the same?
Yeah, well, I know you think they're not, but we'll distinguish it. Explain to us.
The testimony in California would suggest that a sale of a book is a smaller number than the number of books in print because the publishers print.
So why is that? Why does that have anything to do with the fact that there was no harm?
I'm not sure it does, and we're not arguing that the different statement is the reason why we get to bring our claims in this case. We're arguing that it is a different set of defendants who stand in a different position with respect to a company like Bristol Bay. And Bristol Bay is going to take the statements made by the publishers as to the size of the market far more seriously than it does of an author trying to make a good book deal. It is the publishers' statements that create the harm. They're the ones who want to.
Mr. Bauman, it occurs to me, however, though, that this is almost a path you don't want to go down in terms of pure civil procedure. Is it, I mean, it really shouldn't matter what the evidence would be if we found that there was no issue preclusion. Rather, we almost have to look at this just almost like a math problem. You know, are the issues the same? Are the parties the same? All of the kinds of things we look at in determining whether an issue should be precluded or not. Do you understand what I'm saying? And if we start going down the road of what the evidence might have been or whatnot, that almost does away, doesn't it, with the whole concept of issue preclusion? Because we're looking at the result, working backwards and trying to decide whether an issue should have been precluded as opposed to trying to line up this case versus that case and then deciding whether or not there should be relitigation or new litigation.
I agree, Your Honor, that what you really need to do and what Reynolds teaches us is this is an exercise in logic as much as it's an exercise in
law. Well, I called it math, but you called it logic.
And the mathematicians would say they're the same. But what that means in this case is we need to make sure before we embark on this process, that we know exactly what was decided in California.
And the only way, frankly, that we can know exactly is frankly, by a close reading of the interrogatories.
I believe that the jury verdict and the jury instructions are what frames the issues that were actually decided, and everything else is an issue that could have been decided.
And the interrogatory is very specifically directed only to Mr. Cussler.
Correct.
Cussler's representations.
Whether his representations caused damage.
And whether they proximately caused any harm.
And the issue in the Colorado case is very specifically not that any
correct.
Longer, rather whether the agent in the publisher's misrepresentations caused damage.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in fact, it might be the same misrepresentations. The evidence might be exactly the same. But you're saying, as a matter of principle, you get your day in court against these guys as opposed to just Mr. Cussler?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you said that there's no case at all other than the one that you're talking about, which has precluded a second person, a non-party, if you will, based upon the party's judgment?
Where the issues are not submitted to the first case, I'm not aware of it, and the appellees have not cited one.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, let me turn quickly, and then I would like to save a little bit of time for rebuttal.
Tell us why we shouldn't overrule Ruth. Tell us why we shouldn't overrule Ruth. It's an old case.
Two reasons, Your Honor. Before we even get to Ruth, under the plain language of Rule 12b-5, the court is directed to convert. The language says, if in determining a Rule 12b-5 motion, matters outside the pleadings are presented to the court, the motion shall be treated as one for summary judgment. Begin with the plain language of the rule. But more importantly, Ruth stands for the proposition, and it is a well-respected proposition, that in a specifically enumerated affirmative defense may not be decided on a motion to dismiss that is not first converted or treated as a motion for summary judgment. Ruth is consistent with the distinction between the elements of the claim, the failure to state a claim, and the question whether an affirmative defense will bar a claim that otherwise is viable and valid. That's the distinction between enumerated affirmative defenses in Rule 8C and elements of a failure to state a claim that is part of Rule 12b-5 motion. Conflating the two and saying, in this circumstance, the court can look not only well beyond the complaint in the Colorado action, but to thousands of pages of testimony and argument, which of course is not evidence, but argument from California, and reach a decision to bar a claim in Colorado based upon its assessment of those facts and do that in the guise of a Rule 12b motion is also unprecedented. We are not aware of any case in which that has been done either. The appellees cite two cases on this court, including the court's more recent decision in Denver Post against Ritter, where the court used judicial notice in the context of a Rule 12b-5 motion, but the Ritter case did not involve a specifically enumerated affirmative defense. The Ritter case dealt with the question of whether, based on the judicially noticed facts and the allegations in the complaint, it stated a claim under the Colorado Open Records.
What is it that makes the fee-shifting statute depend on the summary judgment context rather than the motion to dismiss?
The language of the fee-shifting statute applies only to a dismissal under Rule 12b for one of the five enumerated grounds, including Rule 12b-5. A dismissal under Rule 56 does not subject an unsuccessful litigant to attorney's fees and costs. That's the difference.
Okay.
In this case, as you know from the review of the record, the proceedings on a motion for issue preclusion that goes off under Rule 12b involves substantial litigation activities. The decision below is not yet final, but the courts below, trial court, has indicated it will award over $800,000 in fees if this appeal is upheld. This is not an insubstantial matter, and it points out why Ruth, which does not itself deal with the fee-shifting statute, is an appropriate line to draw. affirmative defenses should not go off on Rule 12b.
Well, Ruth was issued well before the tort statute, the fee-shifting statute.
Right.
So, and under federal law, as you, I'm sure you know, that's not the rule. There are fees can be awarded. Not fees, I'm sorry. You can rule on affirmative defense on 12b-5 motion.
Right. And as Your Honor pointed out, the sequencing here matters because at the time the legislature put the fee-shifting statute in place, it was entitled to rely upon the fact that Ruth was the law of the land. It's this land, and that attorney's fees, litigants like my client, would not be subject to attorney's fees for matters that don't fit within the narrow confines of Rule 12b-5 and the fee-shifting statute. If the court has no further questions at this time, I will reserve the balance of my time.
You may.
Thank you.
Respond.
Chief Justice Bender, and may it please the court. My name is Reed Newright. I represent Simon & Schuster. With me today at counsel table with Greg Tampkin and Aaron Hughes representing Penguin Books and Mr. Tai G representing Peter Lampack. I intend to reserve 10 minutes for Mr. G to address the 12B issue. I'm here to talk about collateral estoppel. As an initial, there are really three parts to my argument. Number one, I want to remind you precisely what it was that the California jury decided and compare it to the allegations in the Colorado case. Second, I'd like to talk about the question on which the court granted certiorari, which is whether collateral estoppel cannot ever apply to proximate causation when it involves another defendant. And then third, I'd like to inform the court what we believe to be the appropriate tool or mechanism for actually assessing this question of the identity part of issues. When is an issue identical for collateral estoppel purposes? The first point, I think, is accurately described in the comparison chart that we provided to you on page 24 of our brief, which compares the California Fourth Amended cross complaint, which is the one at issue in California, and the allegations in the Colorado First Amended complaint. The claims for relief are identical, fraud. The alleged misrepresentations, I think Mr. Bauman has just conceded, are for all material purposes identical. Over 100 million books sold, over 100 million copies, 100 million readers. The alleged reliance, and this is really the linchpin of the whole case, the alleged reliance of Bristol Bay, the action or inaction, as described in the California jury instructions, of Bristol Bay, based on those misrepresentations, is identical. Signed the contract, and made the movie. The claimed damages in both cases, all the losses associated with making the film in excess of $50 million, are identical. So when the California jury finds, as they did, and I have to take a slight issue, Justice Rice, with your characterization of what the jury found, they didn't find Clive Cussler's misrepresentations didn't cause harm. What they found was Bristol Bay's reliance on Clive Cussler and as explained by the Court of Appeals, were Peter Lampack. Peter Lampack's misrepresentations did not cause the harm. It was the reliance of Bristol Bay that did not cause harm. So if you look at our chart, which says alleged reliance purchased film rights of Dirk Pilk novels, made the film Sahara, and the jury concludes that was not a substantial factor in causing the harm, you look at Colorado and say the same reliance did cause harm, was a substantial factor, those cannot be consistent. And it is for that reason that their claim here in Colorado, based on their reliance, not different speakers, but based on their reliance, is precluded.
Well, I guess I'm not positive about your distinction. Do you have the exact language of that interrogatory in front of you? I'm not even sure that it makes a difference, but since you brought it up, because I thought the exact language was Bristol Bay's reliance on Cussler's misrepresentation a substantial factor in causing harm?
That's it. It's okay. In the record on page 371, question number 40.
And what I was focusing on is Cussler's misrepresentations.
That's correct, but the actual subject of that sentence was Crusader Entertainment's reliance on Cussler's representation. So it is the reliance, the action or inaction of Bristol Bay, which was found not to cause the harm. And so that gets actually to the next question, which is the one on which the court granted certiorari. Can issue preclusion ever apply to bar a lawsuit against a second defendant when there's been a finding of no proximate causation with respect to the first defendant? Respectfully, I disagree with Mr. Bauman. We cited about 9 cases in our brief where that exact thing has happened. And we draw an analogy that I think fairly answers the question. 2 people at the top of the mountain, they both simultaneously roll a boulder down, negligently. Somebody at the bottom of the mountain claims to have been injured. They sue defendant A. The jury finds, in special interrogatories, yes, there was negligence, but this boulder did not cause the harm. Should that person be allowed to sue defendant B? The answer, I think, applying simple collateral estoppel purposes, is no, because the issue, the mechanism of harm, which would have to be proved in the second lawsuit, that boulder caused the harm with respect to the plaintiff, has already been decided. It doesn't matter, and it does not matter that the defendant or that the plaintiff won't get an opportunity to get a jury to decide whether defendant B caused the harm, because the issue has already been decided. Now, is that always the case? No. If there are 2 people up there and they roll simultaneously 2 boulders down, only defendant A is sued, and then they come back and the jury in special interrogatories finds boulder A did not cause this harm.
So perfect identity of the parties doesn't decide the issue.
It does not decide the issue.
So
but perfect identity of the boulders does? Is that your...
That is exactly right.
Is that your theory? Is that the boulder? There could only be one boulder.
Following the teaching of Justice Coates in Reynolds versus Cotton, you apply logic and law to decide what the issue was. And if the same alleged mechanism of harm is claimed, and the first jury has found that that mechanism of harm did not cause, you know, it wasn't the proximate cause of the claimed injury, then you can't sue the second defendant.
Well, then, even though I don't really think you ought to get into the facts past just the calculus of issue preclusion, one of the there's allegations are of different boulders, one's bigger, one's smaller. I mean,
if there are allegations, there's
a question of fact as to the boulder itself.
I think, in fact,
I hate to use these sort of analogies because it gets a little bit absurd, but isn't that, in fact, something that would cause some concern with an issue preclusion analysis?
I think that's true. What I accept, though, is what the plaintiffs have alleged in this case. And if you look at the amended complaint in Colorado, the allegations are that they essentially say this is the same boulder. The allegations are that Clive Cussler and Peter Lampack were involved in a conspiracy to exaggerate the size of the fan base, that the publishers were involved in the same conspiracy to exaggerate the size of the fan base. 3 times in the Colorado complaint, they say that Lampack's statements are identical or uniform with the publisher's statements. And I think Mr. Bauman has conceded that for all intents and purposes, they're materially identical. The reliance alleged, so the boulder in my analogy, is identical. They signed the contract and they made the movie.
Okay, Kelsey, can I just stop you there? Because, I mean, just to take your opposing counsel's argument, I think he's saying, I don't know, he didn't talk about the boulder analogy, but that actually it would make a difference whether the speaker was the author versus the publisher.
I think that there could be a situation where that would be the case, where you could have, you know, a 5-year-old boy coming in saying the sky is falling, and then an astrophysicist comes in and says, no, there's really a meteor up there. You need to pay attention. But what you have in this case is an actual finding that Bristol Bay, that there were misrepresentations, and Bristol Bay relied on those misrepresentations. So Bristol Bay actually believed the little boy, you know, the elderly gentleman who doesn't have access to, they believed him, and they acted by signing the contract and making the move. That's what the jury in California found. So for our position today, it's irrelevant whether there might have been different bases on which to believe the speakers, because there was reliance. And it goes to the nature of fraud, really, as a tort.
Could I ask you, you mentioned the first complaint, which I was just looking at, and it alleges in paragraph 6 that plaintiff believed Lampack and the publishers, they are the ones with the best access to Kussler's book sales information. Moreover, it is customary in the industry to rely upon a literary agent, et cetera, et cetera. So they're suggesting somehow, a little bit contrary, I think, to what you are saying, that there is a difference. They're alleging a difference in the size of the boulder, if you will.
They are alleging
that the agent and the publishers are in a different, better position.
Well, they allege that. Remember in California that the jury was instructed that it's either Clive Kussler or the agent's conduct that would be relevant to the... And so, actually, both Lampack and Kussler's conduct is at issue. This is explained in the Court of Appeals decision. But then the reliance that's alleged and the claimed impact on the hearer, i.e., they believed that there was going to be this fantastic audience for this film, that is alleged to be the same, both in California and in Colorado, and then the action is the same.
Mr. Newrider, good morning. Let me ask, don't we have to give them, under a 12b-5, the benefit of the doubt, in the sense of saying that they thought, oh, Clive Kussler represented it, that's great, but when the publisher said it, that's when it really meant something to us. I mean, don't we have to, under a 12b-5, give them the benefit of the doubt on that?
I don't believe so. I think we accept what they say, that the allegations were materially the same, they had the same impact on them, and then they were able to rely in the very same way that was alleged in California. And I want to leave some time for Mr. G, but I want to conclude by saying that the tool that the court should use to determine whether there's an identity of issues is Restatement Second of Judgments, Section 27, Comment C.
Why would we use a restatement as opposed to our own law? I mean, restatement is basically just a bunch of law professors getting together writing something. Well, I mean, we have some very current law on this issue.
Actually, you have the current law in Reynolds versus Cotton that talks about applying law and logic. What I think the restatement does, and the Court of Appeals applies it, it gives you four questions to ask about whether the discovery
is... But why is the restatement better?
Well, I think it's valuable because it's the thinking of many different courts, and if you read the commentary in the cases cited in the restatement, you'll see situations similar to this one, like the Krett versus Brookdale case that we cite, where we talk about the mechanism of harm. One doctor was alleged not to have diagnosed placenta previa. The jury found no causation, and then the lawsuit against another doctor was precluded. With that, I will cede the time to Mr. G, but we would ask that the court affirm the finding of the Court of Appeals on the collateral estoppel issue.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Ty G. I represent the Lampack respondents. Under Bristol Bay's interpretation of Rule B-5, under no circumstances may a defendant ever raise an affirmative defense in a 12b-5 motion. And the case that Bristol Bay is primarily relying on is the Ruth versus Department of Highways case. What we have pointed out in our brief is that, contrary to the suggestion by Bristol Bay, Ruth can remain good law under this court's jurisprudence because Ruth establishes a general rule. The general rule is that affirmative defenses, particularly those that will require the introduction of evidence, are unlikely ever to be granted a relief under 12b-5. The exception, which is pointed out in the Yost versus Irwin line of cases, dating back to, frankly, the 19th century, is that when the pleader, in this case, Bristol Bay, asserts in its own complaint facts that support an affirmative defense that is dispositive at the pre-answer stage of litigation, that the defendant ought to be able to raise that affirmative defense, and if it can do so without the introduction of outside materials under Rule 12b-5.
By simply looking at the complaint.
That's right. For example, paragraph 21 of Bristol Bay's amended complaint specifically says there is a lawsuit that, frankly, by the time the publishers were completed, was concluded. There was a jury verdict in the case, and in paragraph 21, Bristol Bay acknowledges that. That certainly is notice to the defendant that there is a potential affirmative defense, that is, issue preclusion. And more importantly, for our purposes, it is notice that the plaintiff knows about the existence of this affirmative defense. So under our modern rules, notice is the keystone to everything that we do.
So what does the defendant have to do to counter that and put material facts at issue that then need to be looked at in the lens of the summary judgment context?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of your question.
What kind of lens do you have to look at to see whether or not it should be converted to summary judgment or not? What does a trial judge do with this?
I see. Yes. Rule 12b-5 answers the question, because Rule 12b-5 says that if the trial court is presented with and considers materials, quote, outside the pleadings, close quote, then the trial court must convert the 12b-5 motion into a summary judgment motion. If the trial court is not presented with and does not consider materials outside the pleadings, then it need not convert the motion to a motion for summary judgment.
Isn't that what happened here?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that what happened here? Isn't that what Judge Hagelin did?
No, because under a long line of cases, culminating last year in the Denver Post versus Ritter case, the trial courts have always been permitted to take judicial notice of facts. And in those line of cases, this court and the Court of Appeals have consistently held that judicial notice of facts is not material outside of the pleadings for 12b-5 purposes. And
you can look at your own records that are on file with the court. Prior to cited cases, what is within that ambit? What can you look at under the doctrine of judicial notice?
Yes, I would refer the court to Rule 201B of the Colorado Rules of Evidence. 201B defines a judicially noticeable fact as a fact that is not subject to reasonable dispute. And that's what we had in this case. We had California court documents submitted by both sides with no objection as to authenticity or any other objection that were considered by the trial court. Under those circumstances, under Colorado Rule of Evidence 201D, the trial court was actually required to take judicial notice of these documents from California, which are public records.
So the sentence by Judge Hagelin, the court has thoroughly examined the materials presented to it by the parties concerning the prior California action, including portions of the pleadings, the closing summations of counsel after a jury trial lasting almost 4 months, relevant sections, and so forth, of the trial court's instructions, especially that you consider to be judicial notice?
Yes, because none of those materials are being used for the truth of the statements made in those documents. For example, we're not considering whether or not, in fact, any of the defendants in that case actually made a misrepresentation, nor are we concerned with whether, in fact, the Bristol Bay relied or didn't rely. All that we are using those documents for, and all that Judge Hagelin used those documents for, was to determine whether or not issue preclusion ought to apply. And Bristol Bay readily participated in this proceeding because it was a fair proceeding. It was a proceeding in which both sides got to argue and present judicially noticeable facts to Judge Hagelin to make the argument about whether or not issue preclusion ought to apply. The Yost line of cases is, of course, pre-1941 when this court adopted the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. There have been two occasions when this court has suggested, if not outright stated, that the Yost line of cases continues to be the law in the state of Colorado. The first is the O'Neill versus Simpson case, where this court, when a litigant was here for the fourth time, affirm a motion to dismiss based on issue and claim preclusion, and presumably, the court doesn't say what it used, but presumably used judicially noticed facts. That is, documents that were present in this court, in his own clerk of court, meaning the prior three proceedings when that plaintiff was before this court. The second occasion was in 2000 in State versus Nieto. In State versus Nieto, what did not concern a 12b-5 motion, but it did concern affirmative defenses. And this court defined an affirmative defense as an illegal argument that could subject a lawsuit to, quote, dismissal, close quote, or to a judgment on the merits after a trial. That definition of affirmative defense certainly applies in this case because there is an affirmative defense that would subject Bristol Bay's complaint to dismissal. Now, one thing that I think Bristol Bay forgets in its advancement of this categorical rule is Rule 1A. Rule 1A, beginning of the Colorado Civil Procedure, states that this court must construe the Colorado rules in a way to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive disposition of all actions. And this court has consistently been faithful to that command. And
well, that's a broad statement. But I would like you to, since issue and claim preclusion, they've caused problems to courts, including this court. Would you tell us why the policies behind issue preclusion are advanced by the argument you make here and can fit within Rule 1A without doing injustice?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this court has said that one of the key purposes, key goals of the concept of issue preclusion is to prevent, is judicial efficiency, frankly. And when a litigant has had one bite at the apple, it should not be permitted to have subsequent bites of the apple. When a defendant is permitted to raise issue preclusion as an dispositive affirmative defense at a pre-answer stage, that is certainly consistent with Rule 1A's command about the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of all actions in the state of Colorado. And in this case, that is precisely what happened. The defendants cumulatively spent $800,000 in attorney fees just to get to this 12b-5 motion. And Bristol Bay spent $1.6 million to get to the same stage. There was no discovery, and yet, because of the resources that Bristol Bay brought to bear on this lawsuit, because of the filing of two complaints and the extensive litigation that took place, this is the kind of money we're talking about. But I take issue with my opposing counsel's suggestion that this is expensive. It is certainly expensive, but it's nothing compared to what would have happened had we gone beyond the 12b-5 stage and engaged in the discovery and discovery litigation that characterizes so many of the cases that make lawsuits very expensive in the United States of America.
But I understand that sometimes summary judgment motions are the same, but I mean, isn't in this particular instance almost just a rose by any other name? I mean, so you convert it to a summary judgment and right. You submit the same kind of stuff and there you have it. There's no contested issues of that.
And the same dollars.
Same dollars, same everything. I mean, this is not the case to make that particular point, isn't it? And the consequences of not converting it to a motion to summary judgment from a fee-shifting point of view are fairly significant. So, you know, as a former trial judge, it seems to me that the easiest thing in the world to do is to say, hey, I'm going to treat this as a motion for summary judgment. You guys want to submit anything else? No? Okay, good. Off we go. Why did that happen here?
Justice Rice, I would suggest that the legislature would differ with the perspective you just articulated. In 1986 or 87, the legislature enacted Section 1317-201, and it said that whenever a defendant cannot survive whatever a plaintiff cannot survive a 12B motion. It must, and it is a shall in there, it must pay the defendant's attorney fees. So the only question presented by Section 1372.01 by the legislature for the trial courts is, was this plaintiff able to survive a 12B motion? It's not difficult to survive a 12B motion unless you have filed a baseless complaint. And in this case, you have Bristol Bay having full knowledge of having litigated the very issue that it wants to relitigate in Colorado. And to boot, Bristol Bay puts in paragraph 21 of its complaint that, in fact, we know that we have litigated that issue and it is pending in the state of California. Under these circumstances, it makes no sense to circumvent the legislature's intent with regard to Section 1372.01. Every time there is baseless litigation, someone must pay the attorney fees. And the legislature has made the policy decision that if you bring a baseless lawsuit based on a tort theory and you cannot survive that 12B motion, you must pay. And this is as simple as that. And this court itself has recognized the mandatory nature of 1317.201. I would not go so far, Justice Rice, as to say that every trial court is required to treat every motion to dismiss as a 12B motion when it considers other facts. But that is what Justice Haglund did. And there is nothing wrong with what Judge Haglund did. There's nothing wrong with what Judge Haglund did because he did not go outside the pleadings. Only when you go outside the pleadings are you required to convert to a Rule 56 motion. And it was not required to do so. The statement that Mr. Bauman made about the sequence of the Ruth case versus the statute is one that I think is not weighty in this particular case. In other words, Ruth was decided in 1962, I believe. The statute was enacted in 1987. The suggestion is that the legislature was relying on the Ruth line of cases in enacting 1317.201, and therefore it, quote, expands. It expands the statute beyond what the legislature intended. There's two problems with that. One is that to focus on the Ruth line of cases is to ignore the Yost line of cases, and is also to ignore O'Neill versus Simpson, and is to ignore State versus Nieto. The second thing is that in Jones versus Bach, United States Supreme Court.
Can I ask you? You're basically saying that there are exceptions to the Ruth statute.
That's correct.
Case law, right, by Judge Pringle, I think it was 63.
But, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you cite two cases, State versus Nieto and O'Neill, both of which were unusual. State versus Nieto was a CJA case, so it was a little different. The procedure's different, as you, I'm sure, know.
Right.
And secondly, O'Neill was a little different. It's a war law case causing a lot of problems over many years, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So that's your, and the other is judicial notice, that all the taking into consideration of everything that happened in California is under judicial notice.
That's right.
And that's your argument as to why Ruth still stands but doesn't apply in this case. Have I got it?
That's right. The Ruth line of cases has a statement that says suggests that affirmative defenses may never be
I think it says that, not
yes.
Suggests.
Okay. That affirmative defenses may never be asserted in a motion to dismiss. Well, number one, the court was not required to get there. The actual holding in Ruth was that a motion to dismiss may not be affirmed if there is no record evidence to support the motion to dismiss, different from our case. But in any event, the point is that The no, this court has never addressed the Yost versus Irwin line of cases post 1941. And you're right, Justice Bender, that those two cases do suggest that the Yost versus Irwin line of cases continue to survive in the new under the new post 1941 rules of civil procedure. I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time for Mr. Neubreiter.
You may.
A bit unorthodox, but I had one or two more points I wanted to make. In particular, I wanted to address the H&H case, which was raised by Justice Marquez. That case came up in an interesting procedural posture. It was whether the trial judge should deem inconsistent verdict and hence grant a mistrial. Interestingly, they did deem the contract finding there inconsistent. But I think what was missing in that case, which we have here, is specific findings. You didn't have an articulation of what the material misrepresentations were. You didn't have specific findings. There wasn't a special jury instruction or special findings, which allowed on appeal the court to say, you know what, we really don't know what the court did, what the jury did, and in that procedural posture, we have to affirm we're not going to grant a mistrial. In this case, on the other hand, we do have the specific jury findings. And Justice Rice, you asked why we turn to the restatement of judgments, section 27. I think that is consistent with this court's holdings in Reynolds, which is there's a balancing here, the importance of having cases tried only once and preserving judicial resources. We respectfully ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Let me start at the back and work forward. That is on the conversion question. It is, in fact, true that if this court sanctions the dismissal, in this case under Rule 12b-5, for failure without requiring conversion, then there is no reason why anyone would ever not convert. It is the same analysis. In a issue preclusion case, by definition, the reviewing court must review proceedings in some other proceeding to determine what happened. Now, sometimes it's really simple. Sometimes it's in front of the same court. But in this case, it's not simple at all. It's much more like the analysis that is consistent with a conversion motion. I'm thinking of looking at these facts. I look at them this way. What do you think, as Justice Rice, you suggested, perhaps a chance to put something else in? That's the conversion feature.
And here. Counsel, can I interrupt you right there? Is there anything else that you would have put in under Rule 56?
I don't believe there is anything that we did not get in front of the court. But remember, Justice Rice, the case here came up on a slightly odd procedural posture because the question was first litigated in the guise of a motion to stay. The original proceedings in front of Judge Hagman were on a motion to stay. Clearly, on a motion to stay, you can put in anything you want. There's no issue of Rule 56 versus Rule 12. Both parties put in information, materials from California, made their arguments. Judge Hagman said, if and when this becomes final, I will then consider this. It became final. A Rule 12b, a formal Rule 12b motion was filed. We responded to that and said, you have to convert this because there's all this extra record material being submitted. And the court ignored that, and a different trial judge, Judge Mullins, in a one-page order, granted the motion to dismiss. So the reference to what Judge Hagman did is in a different procedural posture. In the rule,
It just seems that that's a distinction without a real difference here. I mean, you didn't have any material fact that you wanted to introduce or allege. You want a triable issue of fact here. So, I mean, Judge Hagman did have everything in front of him regarding the comparison that's required by the issue preclusion doctrine, correct?
Yes, he did. In the context of
so this is very formulaic. I mean, unless the magic words are said, whatever, the water is sprinkled, issue preclusion doesn't apply.
Right.
In this case, the reason that you would have to pay the attorney's fees.
That's the reason we have to. I mean, the harm to us, of course, is the attorney's fee shifting provision. But in other cases, it would be important, I would submit, that the litigants know that they're going to have the opportunity to put in any additional information. That's the notice.
Well, what would you?
Not in this case. I'm not saying
these are big-time attorneys, big-time case. You could have asked for that conversion, right?
We did.
Okay, but I mean, based on alleging some fact that summary judgment, where the judge could actually look to see whether there was a triable fact.
What we asked for was that the trial court honor the language of the rule and the trial court honor this court's guidance in Ruth, which was if it's in a specifically enumerated affirmative defense, you have to convert. And in converting, you would avoid the problems that we face now.
So, counsel, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to clarify, I'm sure I understand your position. So in asking for the conversion, you were simply relying on the language of the rule, or were you also suggesting that these other materials did not come within, you know, the concept of judicial notice? They were materials outside the pleadings.
They clearly were materials outside the pleadings, but I don't dispute the fact that a court can take judicial notice of what happened in another court, assuming the materials are provided to it properly and there's no question of authenticity. And we don't challenge that that's what happened here. The materials that were provided were authentic, and they were necessary to make the issue preclusion analysis in this and any other case. It will always happen that way. And there is a reason, I submit, why the cases in this court, post-Ruth, deal with it in summary judgment. Reynolds is a summary judgment case. It avoids this issue. Everybody gets notice below that they're going to have to put materials in the record so that the court can make whatever decision it wants to make. And that gets me back to Justice Holbrook's question, which I don't think Mr. Neurider answered, which was how is the judge supposed to decide? What standard are you supposed to use in determining how to review the materials from the record? That's what happened here, is different trial judges, specifically Judge Haddon in the context of a motion to stay, the Court of Appeals on reviewing it de novo, said, we look at the arguments and we come to this conclusion. There's no guidance on how that should happen. And I submit that in the context of a Rule 12 motion, where you must give benefit to the plaintiff, all benefits to the plaintiff, it's improper to preclude us because, in the words of the Court of Appeals, these are virtually identical actions. They need to be specifically identical. They're not, and this court should reverse and remand for trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank both parties for their arguments and their briefs. The case will be submitted and the court